slides, even though I have a few. What I wanted to do is I actually wanted to kind of spell out what he tried to say a little bit. And I tried to get this board out without disrupting anything and failed miserably. So let me see if I can move this over a little bit so everybody can kind of see without hopefully falling, knocking the board down. So what I'm going to describe you guys is considered probably the most basic theory in terms of the gospel progressions. I should say at the outset, I don't necessarily buy this. But it is one that you will run across a ton if you do a lot of extra reading. So we'll start down here with Mark. Most people think that Mark came first. Part of the reason for that is because most of the early manuscripts that we do have come from the Gospel of Mark. It was also shorter. And since it's the shortest of the four, and we seem to have the earliest manuscripts, most people believe that Mark seems to have come first. Matthew is the second one that tends to be on our list. And Matthew seems to have pulled information from Mark. And so he took information from Mark. Gospel of Mark was around, and so he took it. And next you have the Gospel of Luke. And Luke also seems to have pulled from Mark. So he read Mark. He knew that there were some stories going around. And he said, oh, okay, yeah, that sounds like a good thing. And so he pulled some information from the Gospel of Mark. And so there are parts of Matthew and parts of Luke that sound an awful lot like the Gospel of Mark. And so they say that's pretty obvious. But then they say, you know, there's some stuff in Matthew and stuff in Luke that these two agree on, but it's not in Mark. And so they go, where'd that come from? And they don't know. So they say, let's call it Q. And that's what they did. They call it Q. And then they say, Matthew pulled from Q, and Luke pulled from Q. Q is so readily accepted among a lot of scholarship that you can actually go to the library, okay, a biblical library, and you can find Q. I mean, really, we've never found Q. We don't actually know if Q even exists. But that's how readily accepted it is in a lot of biblical scholarship, is so much so that some people say, yeah, this is Q, and then they'll like print copies of it, and you can actually go and find it. We have never, ever, ever discovered Q. Personally, what makes more sense to me, and call me crazy, what makes more sense to me is Matthew wrote his gospel, and then Luke, being the historian that he is, either talked or borrowed from Matthew and said, yeah, this is good stuff. I'm a historian. I wasn't there, so let me just gather information. So he would gather from Mark, he would gather from Matthew, and he compiled his gospel. And then there is no Q, because Matthew was there. So why would he need an extra source? That's me, though, and I'm a low man on the totem pole, and nobody reads my writing. So for what it's worth, there it is. But this is your very basic, bare-bones theory of all this kind of stuff. I have to say this, though. This is a bare-bones theory. If you ever do actually like do a Google search thinking that you're going to find something really fun, get ready, because guess what? There's an A, and there's an X, and a Y somewhere. And some of these will say, this one goes into here, and also goes into here, and this one goes over to Matthew, and A goes into Luke, and they just have stuff all over the place. And it's just like, where in the world did that come from? And the answer is, I don't know. Some people just want to make the world complex. So basically the way they're doing this with all these A, B, X, Y, Z is they're looking at word choices. And they're looking at general stylistic writing. You write in a certain way. And since you write in a certain way, if you start writing differently, people will assume that somebody else is writing. You're borrowing from somebody else's. And so that's what they're doing. So they're looking at like Luke and Matthew, and they're saying, well, Luke and Matthew write in a particular way. But whenever we have something that doesn't look that certain way, it obviously came from another source. By the way, they do this all throughout the Bible. This is not just a thing from the Gospels. So be careful what you get. There's a big special fancy word for it. And it is called redactors. So if you ever open up like a commentary or a book and it says, this is a third redactor, this is what they're talking about. They're saying there's multiple authors in this book and you're just reading this one. Isaiah is notorious for this. Isaiah has two very big parts. And so a lot of commentaries and such will say, yes, this first part, this is the first redactor. The second part, this is the second redactor. And then they'll say, we don't know which one was actually Isaiah, if any of them. We just know that there's two redactors. I have one commentary at my house that has five in for Isaiah. Five redactors. You know how much weight I give this commentary? Not much. But that's just it. So you can, anytime you see any difference in any language at all, you can be like, yes, obviously a new redactor. It couldn't possibly be that Isaiah, as he aged and kept adding to his book and his scroll, didn't just happen, grow up and change his style of writing a little bit, as we all do. That would be silly. Why would we think something so obvious as that? But anyway, so this is just something that you guys may want to be aware of as you guys kind of delve into some of this stuff. And again, I don't necessarily buy it, but it is something that's all over the place. And so if you do some of this study, you're probably bound to run into it. Yeah?
Who came up with the Q? I mean, why would they just say, maybe it's the Holy Spirit?
It's okay, so... In the history of biblical studies, you have several different time periods. And as the time periods progressed, as people got to be, dare I say, more technical, this is kind of what's occurred over the lifespan. To be honest with you, a lot of this stuff started developing around the 15th, 16th century. As the Renaissance started picking up, people started to try to delve into things to find even more meaning. It's one of those weird things, though, because, we're Lutheran, of course, and so Luther was around in the 16th century, right, 1500s, and we say, yeah, Luther was there. The irony with all of that is, though, is that Luther actually went back, and he said, look, we've added too much technical stuff, we need to get back to where we came from, as the rest of the world said, no, we haven't gone far enough, we need to go the other way. So even though Luther was a part of that Renaissance era, and he fit into that to a certain degree, in that, he studied Greek and Hebrew, which was unheard of in the Catholic Church. Right? He wanted to do Latin. And he knew Latin, but, they didn't want you to read, the original languages. So Luther was definitely a part of that. But again, his part was he wanted to get back more to the original. So he read a lot of the church fathers and so on and so forth. And so a lot of his stuff kind of crept in from the early church, kind of as opposed to a lot of the other sources that came in and said, no, we need to make this more technical. And that's kind of what happened. And so, basically over the time, every generation, it seems, tries to add another technical field, and so kind of gets more and more and more technical, and so on and so forth. So when exactly this crept up, I don't know. But it could have been any time after basically the 16th century. Somewhere around there. And again, this is just the Gospels. The Old Testament's not exempt. For instance, if you're reading the Torah, don't think that these scholars are going to say that Moses wrote it. They're going to talk about J, E, P, and D, which are their various texts that they claim have crept in. Again, most of it's nonsensical. So, for instance, P stands for priestly text. Basically, the whole book of Leviticus would be in a priestly text. Because there's no way that, Moses wrote anything like that. That'd be silly to think that the Bible is actually going to teach the truth. So, anyway, I digress. But, again, a large part of what I'm trying to do here is just, again, you guys are kind of venturing out into this big world of the biblical study, and these are some of the things that you're going to run across, and I don't want them to confuse you out of the gate as you kind of run into them. They are there, and there are theories about as long as you go. About as far as you go. So, realize that those are there. Any questions on that? Okay. Well, moving right along here. The book in my opinion, has the same problems that it's had every week, and we've kind of covered this again. I was actually telling you guys about it before. It's got great principles. I absolutely love their principles that they give. It's got horrible follow-through, which is unfortunate, but that's the way it's kind of done. So look at the principles, good principles. Context is queen here. And it's going to be queen in every book of the Bible. Context is queen. Make sure you do the contextual thing. I say context is queen because everybody says grammar is king, right? If grammar is king, then context has to be queen. So, that's the way it goes. Yeah. So anyway, context is queen because grammar is king. And so we want to deal with context, context, context. Read through the text. Right? I was actually surprised he actually didn't say this. He made such a big deal out of biblical theology, but never once did he actually say, just read the text. A whole lot of errors could be fixed if people just read through the text. Right? If you have the time and you want to understand the gospel reading, read the gospel all the way through. If you don't have time for that and you want to know about a particular passage, just read at least the chapter before and the chapter after. Trust me when I tell you, it'll do a whole lot of good to do that. That part of Scripture is placed in that place for a reason. And so just understanding that the very context itself will actually help you in leaps and bounds. Have you ever understood, like, so for instance, here's a good example. I mean, all of these are great examples, but one of the great examples I love is the parable of the prodigal son. And we just had that last week, and it's a great parable. We get it, but what's really fascinating is if actually you look at the context of it, the Gospel of Luke has that parable as one of Jesus' teachings, but it's a series of four parables. And what's fun about it is each parable is weird. And each one is weirder than the first one. So you have the first one, which is the lost sheep. And we go, okay, that's not that weird. I mean, it is in a certain degree. I mean, this guy just leaves his 99 sheep alone without protection and goes and finds this one sheep that's lost. But you can see somebody doing that. And so you're like, okay, I get that. That makes some sense. And then, of course, he has a big party when he gets back, which is also a little weird. Right? Because one of the things that they do at a party, right? Slaughter an animal. Feed everybody. Right? So here he just saved an animal, and now he's going to go, yeah, let's have a party. So you've got this kind of odd scenario going on. And then the second one's the lost coin. And so here you have this woman who loses a coin and takes the lamp and can't find it, and she sweeps it, and then she finds it, and then again, what does she do? She throws a party, right? Which costs probably three times as much as this coin that she just lost. So she loses a coin and then throws a party that's well worth well more than what the coin is. And then you have the prodigal son right in the middle of that. And then all of a sudden, the prodigal son, which has all kinds of ironies, just all over the place. And it's weird. This father acts so strange. And the son is kind of acting weird too, being really super rude and asking for his father basically to die. You know, and you got all these guys. And then after that, you have a shrewd manager. Right? So if the prodigal son's not weird enough, you go to the next one, you have a shrewd manager, which is this weird parable. And you just go, what in the world does this mean? But you realize if you start reading them all together, you're like, okay, weird, weirder, weirder yet, and then this is the weirdest. And all of a sudden you go, oh, Jesus is talking about the kingdom of God. And it's not all really understandable by our terms. Now, they're going to talk about parables next week. But the point of the matter is if you just read the prodigal son and you pull it out and you just read it, you miss some of that prior context that flows before it and some of the context that flows after it. And you might actually miss the very large point that Jesus is making through his teachings. So context. Context is important. Read your context. What comes before and after. Outside resources can be helpful. After you read the context of the Bible. And I have to say that, right? Outside resources are great. But if you start with your outside resources, you will do yourself a disservice. Read the Bible first. Then read what's before and after in the Bible second. And then after that, if you have time, read outside resources. A lot of these outside resources can be helpful. Study Bibles are great for this. They got those study notes that give you a lot of historical points that you might not understand or know. That's great. Histories and isagogical materials. Isagogics, if you can remember, that's beginning things. Right? That's beginning things. So like he mentioned, like this, you know, introduction to the New Testament. That's a great resource. There's a couple of them out. I think it's by Thomas Nelson. They're actually great resources as well. That are just beginning things, just telling you about the book and what's going on and all that kind of stuff. Those are great resources, especially if you're trying to pick up some of the nuances that's going on in the Bible, because these guys have studied it, and it's good to kind of do those. One of those that's actually somewhat forgotten, but I think is actually really, really, really important to read, I think every Christian should have Dan Meyer's book, Josephus. Right, Josephus is this book. Basically, it's written by a guy named Josephus, and he wrote a history of that time period. Now, he was not a Christian; he was a Jew, and he wrote a lot about that stuff. But what's really fascinating is, and is, for instance, in the book, he points this out: like when the desolation comes, right, or when the desolation is in the holy place, and all that kind of stuff. When you read those texts, if you have read Josephus, you know exactly what he's talking about. It's the fall of the temple. And basically, the Christians did exactly what they're supposed to do. He said, yeah, when the desolation comes, then you guys need to flee from Jerusalem. And so, here comes the desolation, and everybody flee, all the Christians flee from Jerusalem. And so, this happened in 70 AD, that the entire thing is written down by Josephus. Josephus, by the way, also talks about Jesus a little bit. There is some debate because there's one of his histories that has this really long, extended thing about Jesus in there. And we don't know where it came from. It doesn't appear to be in the actual Josephus, like some of his earlier manuscripts. In his earlier manuscripts, he does mention Jesus. He does talk about Jesus just a little bit. But the long extra thing seems to be added much later on into his actual history. But I do suggest the Meyer edition, Josephus, because it's not the full Josephus. And you don't want the full Josephus. Full Josephus is huge. It's like a couple volumes long. This Josephus from Meyer, though, is it's a selected, most important for Christian passages kind of thing. As he will say, and I've heard him talk about this, as he will say, it's almost like somebody went through Josephus and said, boy, what's good for Christians to read, and pull all those things out and put it in a book? Who would do such a thing? And then he'd go, I did. And then he, you know. So I have bought the book. I have read the book. It's actually a pretty good resource for understanding some of these things that we talked about, especially in the Roman world. And some of those other things. So these are all kind of good resources in terms of looking at the scriptures and the books of the Bible, specifically the Bible. Yep.
Where would you buy that book, Joseph?
What's Meyer's first name?
Amazon.
Is it David P. or more than a skeleton in God's closet? A skeleton? Is it David?
Daniel.
David. Not all kinds of. It's either David Daniel or Paul. and it's Meyer spelled like M-A-I or
M-A-I-E-R.
Yeah. So it's not like a M-A-Y-E-R or anything like that. Basically what it comes down to is this: anything by that man is gold by it. Even his fiction is fantastic. He's got, three fiction books? Maybe more. One is called Flames of Rome, which is great. One of them is called Skeleton in God's Closet, and the other one is called More Than a Skeleton in God's Closet. Those are his fiction books. He has several other books, though. By the way, he's an LCMS historian. He's a great guy. He's spoken at conventions and everything else. And I think we actually have some of his classes, like, in the library over there. Great, great guy. So anyway, but yeah, his Josephus book is absolutely fantastic. And it's great for putting things in context for all these kind of things. Get ready, though, if you want to read Josephus, you might need to jump over a few parts. There are some pretty horrendous things. That's just Josephus being a historian and saying, look, this is what happened. Unfortunately, some of the things that happened were really, really bad. So, just be ready. Some of it's kind of gory.
Amazon.
Is it David P?
It's Paul.
Is it?
It's Paul. Yeah. I mean, if that's the right thing that I pulled
up. Oh, probably.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just assuming that maybe Paul.
No, that's right. That's right.
Said
the essential word. Josephus, the essential word, but follow mine. Yep, she's right. I think I called him Daniel. So there we go. I was super close. Super close. Alright. Here's something that was not in the book that I wanted to put in here and talk about because this is something that is run rampant throughout a lot of this stuff. Question assumptions. Some of those are going to be your own assumptions that you're bringing to the table. Others maybe are assumptions that people have given to you. By all means, read. Some metaphors are simply not metaphors. They're simply not. And we have to evaluate that. If you take something as a metaphor, look for exegetical clues. So, for instance, in the book, if you were able to read, he talks about this one scenario where Jesus says, if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. And he goes, see, this is classic. Jesus is over-talking. And he says, Jesus doesn't really mean that he wants you to gouge your eye out. Jesus is simply making a point. I disagree. I don't believe that that's one of those things that we can say. There's nothing exegetically that would cause us to say, oh yeah, Jesus is obviously just, you know, he's just, you know, giving us this random over-teaching thing. I've never even heard of over-teaching before until I read this book. I just don't buy it. Now, and usually how we do with this exegetically is this. Is it really our eye that causes us to sin? No. Is it really our hand? Like our hand is a mind of its own? No. It's our heart. Our heart is sinful. And we can do nothing with our heart except for to have it cleansed by the blood of the Lamb. So this is usually how we handle this. Yeah. If your eye has a mind of its own and it causes you to sin, gouge out your eye. I don't think Jesus is metaphorically at all. Or is he overspeaking? But look, it's just, you know, and he also does the same thing with, like, Luke and Matthew, where he says, look, these two passages, right, the blessed are the poor in spirit, and blessed are the poor, these sound alike, and therefore they must be Luke and Matthew's version of the same teaching. Well, again, I disagree. I actually said this in the sermon not too long ago, because what's really fascinating is those two speeches are not alike in a lot of ways. There's a couple things that are very similar. Like, you know, Matthew says, blessed is the poor in spirit. Luke says, blessed is the poor. However, that being said, realize that Jesus was going from place to place to place teaching. Is it possible that he gave one teaching over here to this group and one teaching over here to this group and some of it sounded similar? Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's what we have. I think we have Matthew having one part of the teaching, and, you know, we call it the Sermon on the Mount, and then we have this other one from Luke, which I think is actually called Sermon on the Hill or something like that. But are they very similar? Absolutely. But are they different teachings? Also, absolutely. If you read through the whole passages, you can actually see that play out. They become increasingly different the further on you go. But again, he's going to try to harmonize them, to make them make sense, because he doesn't want to live in a world that has these contradictions. And that's kind of a danger. Sometimes the Gospels are just speaking for themselves. So look for exegetical clues to these things, though. You know, if Jesus is over-speaking, so to speak, on purpose, he's going to tell you. He's going to let you know. And we've kind of talked about this in the past. The passages, most of the time, will give you clues as to what they're trying to say and the way they are meant to be taken. Now, are there some of them where we go, wow, I just don't get that? Yeah, absolutely. There are some things that we don't always necessarily get. But a lot of this stuff has exegetical clues found in the passage that will teach us exactly how to take them and how to go. Now, one of the fun things that I think is very true is, you know, he's gotten a lot of terms wrong throughout this whole series. Today, he gets it right. Biblical theology is the study of a particular book of the Bible, and it is letting that book speak for itself, which is a great way to kind of look at this. This is as opposed to systematic theology. Systematic theology takes a topic and then scours the Bible for the topic. So, for instance, if we were talking about the Holy Trinity, we would say, okay, how does the Holy Trinity fit in all the Bible? But in biblical theology, we're going to say, look, if we were to look at the Trinity, we're going to say, how does John talk about the Holy Trinity? You mean 1 Corinthians? No, not 1 Corinthians, just John. Just his book. Just his Bible. How does he talk about it? And so that's going to be the distinction between biblical theology versus systematic theology. Systematic is looking at the whole Bible in its entirety. Biblical theology is just looking at that one book and saying, what does this author of this book say about this topic or anything? Anyway, so that's the difference between biblical and systematic. He actually gets that one right. Hooray! Applaud his greatness. Okay, I have actually talked for a long span of time this particular time. Are there anything else? Any questions? Any thoughts? Comments? We have about 4 or 3 minutes? 3 or 4 minutes? Yeah.
Confused me. I mean, you're saying one's better than the other. Because I always think, you know, our Bible class stuff, when we don't understand what's in one book, we start going to other places in the Bible to try to find out. You're systematic.
If you
limit yourself to just one book, you're going to sometimes get your...
It's not a better or worse thing. It's just two different types. And that's just the honest truth. It's just two different types. So, for instance, looking at the Trinity, we know that the Holy Trinity, and we break it into two separate parts, right? We say that the immanent Trinity is how the Trinity works within itself, right? The God the Father is not God the Son, not the same person as God the Son. God the Son is not the same person, per se, as God the Holy Spirit. But they're all three gods, and they're all the same essence, they're all 100% God. And so this is how we talk about what we call the immanent Trinity. But if you read the Gospel of John, for instance, that's not how he talks about the Trinity. In the Gospel of John, you see God the Father sending the Son, and then the Son ascending up to heaven and sending the Spirit. And so you have kind of this three-part hierarchy kind of going in with the Father sending the Son and the Son sending the Spirit. That's Johannine theology. That's in the Gospel of John. Now, John isn't saying there that God the Father is higher up in actuality in terms of like Jesus isn't really God or something. That's not what he's saying. He's just saying these are how these guys function. But that's what John focuses on. That's how he talks about it. Now, if you read the rest of those scriptures, you'll find the immanent Trinity kind of being on full display. But if we're looking at just this book of the Bible and we're saying let's talk about biblical theology, we're going to get this view of God the Father sending the Son and the Son sending the Spirit. Does that make more sense?
Yeah, it seems like you need that systematic theology.
Well, yeah, you need both. I mean, ultimately, when you're looking at just the book of the Bible, you need both. And this is one of those things, I think this is probably why you brought it up in this chapter, too. Because the different Gospels are highlighting kind of different points. Jesus was around for a while. We think about 3 years. He did a lot of stuff. You know, he did a lot of miracles, and he said and taught a lot of different things. And each gospel picks up on different parts of that. And they're going to display and give you different parts of that. And so we need to read each, we need to read each gospel, and then we need to ask that question, like, okay, so why did Mark want to put this in his gospel? You know, it's a good question. I mean, why did Matthew leave that part out? You know, obviously Mark had it, so obviously it was in there. So why did Matthew say, okay, I don't want to talk about that, I want to talk about this? You know, these are good questions, and a lot of it has to do with who they're talking to. You know, Matthew is definitely talking to the Jews. You know, his genealogy goes back to Jews. He's constantly quoting Old Testament scripture. He's constantly making this argument that Jesus is the Messiah that has been long awaited within the faith of the Jews and of Israel, all of Israel. And so he's making this big argument. Whereas Luke is most definitely saying, look, he came here for you, the Gentiles. And so he's going to pick out things that are more geared for that. They're all true, but realize that they're picking apart. Now, they're also limited on space, right? They can only, you know, paper's expensive, writing is hard, and this is kind of one of those things where as you kind of write this stuff down, you know, just realize that this is kind of all over the case. So that's where biblical theology kind of comes in handy, because it's starting to look at, okay, what does Luke have to tell us, you know, in this kind of realm? It's not discounting any of the other gospels. It's not saying that the other gospels are like subpar. It's not saying that at all. And systematic theology is very, very important, but so is biblical theology, in that we're looking at this book of the Bible and we're saying, let's look at this book. Does that make sense? Okay, good. Any other questions? I know the butler left, but I got a few seconds. All right. Well, hey, thanks everybody for being here. We will continue on next week. God be with you.
Yeah.